Welcome to the 18th SNI and SNI Digital Baghdad Neurosurgery online meeting, held on October 23rd, 2022. The meeting originator and coordinator was Samer Haws, Universities of Baghdad and Cincinnati. Iraqi Neuro-Oncology, Part 3, Update on Neuro-Oncology Worldwide, 60 Minutes, L&D. The speaker will discuss updates on neuro-oncology. The speaker is Dr. Tiral Patel, Department of Neurosurgery, University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center.
Now we have Dr. Tiral Patel. She's an assistant professor in UT Southwestern. She's a very eminent neuro-oncologist and with a huge achievement already. Welcome, Dr. Patel, for this meeting. And we have the honor to have you here. And we already have many comments from based on your experience. We are happy with that. And now you have the full stage. You are welcome.
Perfect. It's an honor to be invited to speak to the group. Thank you for the invitation. As Summer said, I'm a neurosurgical oncologist. I'm on faculty at UT Southwestern. I've been here for about 8 years. And my practice is primarily intraaxial eloquent location tumors, although I do some skull-based and extraaxial tumor work as well. And today I was asked to talk about new sort of emerging techniques in neurosurgical oncology. And so I'd like to discuss a sleep motor mapping for resection of intraaxial brain tumors. It's maybe particularly relevant with Dr. Mati's last case presentation of that insular glioma. I think as a whole in the field in the last 10 years, there's been a significant movement towards more and more awake craniotomies. And although for the surgeon, that provides a lot of comfort in terms of minute by minute, real time feedback about the neurologic status of your patient, it's not always feasible to do an awake craniotomy on everybody, either for patient discomfort, anesthesia discomfort, setup. It's a big undertaking. And so I do personally think we need to think about creative ways to do some asleep mapping, particularly of the motor system, so that we don't feel too scared about all eloquent location tumors and don't always have to think that if it can't be done awake, it can't be done at all. And so, you know, as we were discussing earlier in the day's program, the basic goal of brain tumor surgery is to maximize the extent of resection, minimizing neurologic morbidity, this so-called oncofunctional balance. And we know that there's an increasing number of studies now that demonstrate that prognosis for patients with malignant brain tumors specifically is directly related to extent of resection and performance status, KPS. And so these two papers, I think, are the best pieces of evidence in favor of aggressive surgical resections for low-grade gliomas. And so 20 years ago, skipped forward, but 20 years ago, it was not clear what to do with low-grade gliomas at presentation. And so for many centers, there was a strategy of watchful waiting, and you had a low-grade glioma patient, they didn't have any neurologic deficits, perhaps they presented with a first-time seizure, they're placed on an anti-seizure medication and otherwise fine, and told to just follow up with imaging. And then once the tumor transformed into a high-grade tumor, then we would operate then. And that was a readily accepted strategy for years and years and years, until this very eloquent, elegant paper came out in JAMA in 2012 out of Jacolo's group in Scandinavia. And this paper used the strength of a nationalized healthcare system in a Scandinavian country. And in that country, if you lived in the northern half of the country, you had a hospital that you were referred to that had a strategy of watchful waiting, so maybe a biopsy, but otherwise observation. And if you lived in the southern half of the country, then you were referred to a hospital that had more aggressive surgical resection as the upfront treatment. And so although there's not a lot of randomized controlled trials in neurosurgery, particularly with respect to surgical treatments, this paper was the best evidence of something like that for low-grade gliomas. And it turned out that the patients who were in the resection preferred early upfront aggressive surgical intervention hospital did much better in terms of years of added survival compared to biopsy and watchful waiting. And this is the first piece of very high quality evidence suggesting that upfront aggressive resection at time of diagnosis of a low-grade glioma was the appropriate strategy, provided that the patient was willing to do it. And then this same group published in 2017 in the Annals of Oncology their follow-up data with 5 more years of data. And the solid green line is the hospital in which resection was preferred early, and the solid orange line is the hospital in which biopsy was preferred early. And so you can see that their curves, their Kaplan-Meier curves, continue to separate as the years go on. And so clearly, if you can do a safe resection, it is better for these patients to do it upfront. And then Mitch Berger published in JAMA Oncology in 2020 this an analogous set of data, but not quite as elegant a randomization because it's harder, particularly in the States, but published a piece of data that looked at high-grade gliomas and extent of resection and looked to answer the question, in high-grade gliomas, should we be trying to resect just the enhancing disease? Should we resect the enhancing disease and the non-enhancing disease? Is there a particular subtype of high-grade gliomas that particularly respond to aggressive surgical management? And what Dr. Berger's retrospective review of many hundreds of patients showed was that in patients under the age of 65 with a glioblastoma, resection of both the contrast-enhancing and non-contrast-enhancing disease, if it can be safely achieved, confers a survival benefit. But for patients over the age of 65, it does not. And this is very different than what I was taught in training, which wasn't that long ago, 15 years ago or so, in which it was clear that the only surgical target for a high-grade glioma patient was the enhancing disease, and the flare did not matter at all. And so this is these three papers, the two Jupola papers, and then this Dr. Berger paper in the last 5 years has really pushed the glioma field towards more is more is more is more. And so the more you can take out, the better. And if you just look at the papers that are published, there are the number of publications favoring more aggressive surgical resections versus those that say that aggressive surgery doesn't have a benefit are also widely disparate as the years go on. But as we all know, and as Dr. Mahdi just nicely
said, could you go back to the slide before that?
Yes.
I don't understand that slide. It favors more extensive resection in blue.
Yes.
And the red line says what?
These
no significant
of,
benefit?
Right, that's
no,
correct.
No so significant no significant, so that shows two different results.
No, this is just publications in the literature that say blue, we vote for more aggressive surgical resections, and red, we think that they don't do anything. This is a sampling of how many publications in the year 2005, for example, favored extensive surgical resection versus those manuscripts that came out and said surgery is of no benefit. And so as the years go on, more and more papers say that surgery is of benefit, maximal extent of resection is of benefit, and fewer papers where that line really plateaus would say something like a biopsy alone is the same as a 99% resection.
So I'm still confused. The red line are papers that were published that showed that there was limited resection done, and that this doesn't have to do with it. It's just the number of participating
right.
Stub publications over a period of time.
Correct.
Right.
This only shows one set.
So, what is no significant benefit for resection? What does that mean?
So that would be like a paper that said we had a cohort that had 95% extent of resection. We had a cohort that had a biopsy, and both cohorts did the same, which I don't think anyone who's doing a lot of glioma work these days would believe. But in 2006, you could still find some publications that would say something like that. Many more that would say something the opposite. But in 1992 or 93, the amount of publications that would vote one way versus voting the other way based on their data were quite similar. And so in the last 15 years, there's been more and more people who believe through their data or otherwise that extent of resection matters.
So okay, go ahead. This slide really is only about publications. It's not about the science. Okay.
That's right. The prior three manuscripts, the one in JAMA Oncology, Annals of Oncology, and JAMA are all the science.
Okay. Sorry.
Nope. And so as Dr. Mahdi said, you know, lesions like that one in the insular glioma, in the insular cortex and insular lobe, and lesions like this that are in what we would consider to be the primary hand motor cortex area, can be difficult to resect and difficult to give the patient or their family some guarantee about postoperative outcome, and so motor outcome. And so although there's more and more data to suggest that maximizing extent of resection is a benefit, and I am a believer of that, maximizing extent of resection while keeping patients whole can be difficult, particularly, let's say, for a lesion like this. And so what are the strategies that have been developed in the recent past to maximize extent of resection? Brain mapping. Brain mapping is not new. Brain mapping has occurred for decades and very elegantly for that period of time. But the use of more asleep motor mapping techniques is more new. And then intraoperative MRI. So you can get an MRI in the middle of your surgery to ascertain where you are in terms of your extent of resection, and understand what's left and what that relationship is to critical neuroanatomy, although that is an expensive and sort of cumbersome operation. And then there's 5-ALA, which has been used in Europe for longer than it has in America, but this is a fluorescence a compound that can be ingested orally several hours prior to surgery, and then it breaks down into a compound that can be visualized under blue light with a microscope, and it breaks down preferentially and is absorbed preferentially within high-grade glioma tissues. And so you can differentiate tumor from normal brain using that technique. And so all of these things can help us to maximize extent of resection. I'm going to speak about brain mapping, a particular area of interest of mine. And so this is the idea that elephant cortical and subcortical regions in the brain can be mapped using electrical stimulation, and that when the brain is stimulated, you can elicit either a motor or speech response. And so this can be done in different paradigms, either awake or asleep, and you can map the cortex or the subcortical regions or both. And so the typical awake brain mapping case looks something like this, and many of you will have seen this. And this is sort of the tried and true standard. There's a patient that's usually in some sort of lateral or semilateral position facing an anesthesiologist. There may be a camera and a microphone on them to amplify their visual and speech output for the surgeon to hear. And then the surgeon is at the head of the bed, and there's a little cocoon or tent created so that the patient is not terribly claustrophobic. And now during the course of surgery, they're going to provide motor and speech feedback to the surgeon so that the surgeon knows whether or not the resection can proceed safely. And this works well, but as I said, it's a quite extensive setup and you need special neuroanesthesia. You need a very calm patient. You need, you know, really perfect intraoperative environment for this to not turn dangerous or uncomfortable for the patient. And so places that do hundreds of these, I think, do them very well. But if you have the occasional motor eloquent lesion and you ask your anesthesiologist to do an awake craniotomy two or three times a year, they might look at you funny, you know? And so there's no paradigm for asleep speech mapping, but for asleep motor mapping, you can do some things that are meaningful. And so asleep brain mapping with respect to motor is the idea that you can use modern neurophysiologic monitoring to map the motor system while the patient's asleep. And the advantages are the ones that I described. You know, you can alleviate patient anxiety. They're not, you know, panic that they're going to have to be awake at some point during brain surgery. You can improve the control of intangible variables in the OR. So this is like end-tidal CO2, mannitol administration, brain swelling. You have a huge insular tumor. You try to do that awake, and the patient coughs when the ET tube or LMA comes out, and now the whole brain is out of the head, and there's a bunch of subarachnoid hemorrhage, and it's hard to do a beautiful subpeel dissection and all of this kind of stuff now. And so if the patient is asleep and you don't think you need speech mapping, perhaps all of that becomes a bit smoother. And then importantly, you can also decrease false positives. So if you have a glioma in the superior frontal gyrus and you know that patient is likely to have a supplementary motor area syndrome, an SMA syndrome perioperatively, then that patient may become hemiparetic, hemiplegic in the OR from an SMA syndrome that they will fully recover from over the coming days to weeks. But if they are plegic in the OR, it is the rare surgeon who can take that patient who's plegic and say, oh, it must be an SMA syndrome. I'm going to keep going. It will be fine. I mean, it's hard to know that that's truly a false positive, especially when you're getting that real-time feedback in the OR and your patient's no longer moving. And then obviously for pediatric patients and operative time issues, doing the whole thing asleep is much easier. And so we looked at our data for sleep motor mapping at Southwestern over the course of 4 years. We had 55 patients. This was the early part of my practice. Median age was in the 40s. There's a slight female predominance. And I selected patients based on the proximity of the tumor, either to cortical or subcortical motor pathways. Both were included. And all patients had to have a postoperative MRI within 48 hours of surgery so that we could ascertain extent of resection. And the operative details were that all patients were under general anesthesia with TEVA, and then we monitored motor evoke potentials, somatosensory evoke potentials. And the way that I like to set these cases up is when the patient's asleep under TEVA, you do your craniotomy, and then you take a 1x4 or 1x6 strip electrode and place that over the central sulcus and obtain a phase reversal recording. And this is done in concert with a neurophysiologist who has put little electrodes throughout the contralateral hemi body and all of the relevant muscle groups. And so they're getting EMG signal. And then they're sending a sensory stimulus from the periphery to the brain for measurement of scalp SSEPs. And so then I put that strip down and you get a phase reversal recording. You identify the central sulcus and now you know where motor and sensory are. And then you do direct cortical stimulation either via the strip electrode or via a monopolar or bipolar probe of the cortex to understand exactly where motor is. And then I typically do that every 1 to 5 minutes, depending on how close I am to the motor cortex cortically. And then once you're doing the resection and you want to know about subcortical activity, then you use a monopolar stimulator to map the corticospinal tracts. And you use the general, excuse me, I have to move. You use the general, you use the general paradigm. Hey, Ava, excuse me. Okay, I'm gonna come in 2 minutes. I'm gonna go lock myself in another room. I'm sorry, small children. And so then you use a monocolor subcortical stimulator, and you use the general paradigm that 1 milliamp of cortical or subcortical stimulation indicates 1 millimeter of distance away from the corticospinal tract. And so if I have a monocolor stimulator and I have a perirolandic lesion and I'm stimulating the white matter and I get a response at 10 milliamps, then I know that I'm at least within 10 millimeters of the corticospinal tracts. And then I will dial that down to 5 milliamps and stimulate again. If I get a response, then again at 5 milliamps, I know I'm within 5 millimeters of the corticospinal tracts. And then you can keep gating that until you know exactly how far away you are. And in general, once you're within 5 millimeters of the corticospinal tracts, it's probably time to stop. If you didn't get a response at 5 milliamps, then you know that you're somewhere between 5 millimeters and 10 millimeters away, and you may be able to shave the tumor down a little bit more safely. The resection in my center is halted for significant decrement in the motor evoke potentials that are greater than 50% of baseline, or if you have to use increasing stimulation requirements to achieve the same motor evoke potential response. So for example, if at the beginning of surgery, I can use 10 milliamps of response cortically to get a strong motor evoke potential monitoring, and then by the halfway through surgery, I need 14 or 16 milliamps. It's a warning sign that something is not quite good. And if it's not because of a change in anesthesia, then it may be because the motor system is perturbed. Or if at the same amplitude, 10 milliamps, let's say as an example, now my motor evoke potentials are 50% of the baseline strength, then I might be worried about that also. And so this was our first 55 cases using this paradigm. We had primarily about half of the cohort was glioblastomas, many others with malignant high-grade gliomas, and then a few mets, DNETs, a meningioma, but primarily gliomas and primarily high-grade. And the locations were relatively distributed within the brain. Many frontal parietal lesions, as you would expect in the perirolandic lesion,
region, but many also include gliomas in the non-dominant hemisphere, in which I did not think that we needed any speech mapping. I chose to do a sleep with this motor mapping technique. And these are some representative images of lesions that I resected using this sleep motor mapping paradigm. And so this is a subinsular lesion that I did asleep. This is a lesion in the superior frontal gyrus that you would presume that patient would have a supplementary motor area, a deficit in the perioperative period. And again, if that happened to you while you were doing the case awake, you might be a little bit scared and stop short. This is a perirolandic renal cell carcinoma metastasis with recurrence after radiosurgery. And then this is a large high-grade thalamic glioma, diffuse midline glioma, as it turned out, an H3K27M mutated lesion, all done using a sleep motor mapping. Our institutional series, our mean extent of resection was 92%. We had a gross total resection rate of 58%. And there's a significant lag here, as you would expect, because you're using that data from the sleep motor mapping to say maybe a 98% resection or a 90% resection is the right balance for this patient. And so although the overall extent of resection is high, that data from the intraoperative mapping informs not going for broke on every single patient. I did not have any patients with intraoperative seizures, and this was surprising, but I think that's because I primarily use a monopolar stimulation paradigm, even for cortical mapping. And so the traditional cortical mapping scenarios have used bipolar or Ojimon stimulation, and you get a more precise localization with a bipolar probe, but the pulse train that's used is also more epileptogenic, and so higher rate of seizures, but more precise mapping. And so it's a trade-off, and you should decide patient by patient which you think is most important. But I use a monopolar probe, and that is less seizure provoking.
Can you leave that slide up for a minute?
Yes.
And can you go back to that?
Yeah, it wasn't me, it
auto-advanced. So what you're saying is that the mean extent of resection using your approach was 92%, 93%, right?
That's right.
But the gross total removal rate, that's with all the tumors, I don't understand the difference there. It's 58%?
Right. So that would imply that there are many patients in this cohort that had gross total resection rate is black or white. And so it's either 100% or not 100%. And so there's many patients in this cohort that had extent of resection somewhere between 95 and 98% that would not have been included as a gross total resection. So it decreases that number, but it's still a relatively high volume of resection. And so the mean is much higher than the gross total, because the gross total is binary.
I'm not sure I still understand it. So if you're going and you're working on a lesion and you're able to remove over 90% of the lesion,
mm-hmm.
Are you going to classify that as a gross total resection or not?
No, only if it's 100%.
How do you know it's 100%?
Based on the postoperative MRI within 48 hours.
Okay, we'll come to that. The next thing is, I got that. Next one is 22% of the patients had a preoperative deficit.
That's right.
Of those, about 40% improved.
Mm-hmm. And 10%
got worse. And 10% got worse.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we've done is achieved a high extent of resection. What is the outcome of these people?
Right. I'm getting to that, Dr. Austin. So 10% of patients had new or worsened deficits immediately following surgery. And if you follow that up to 3 months follow-up, 3% of patients, so 5% of the cohort, had a new persistent motor deficit. So approximately 5% of the patients in this model will have new real motor deficits. And that's what I quote patients when I counsel them in the office, that this is a technique that we can use. It eliminates some of the awake craniotomy issues, but not all of them. And it's
Wait a minute. You guys say 9% of the patients, one out of every 10, had new or worse deficits after surgery. And in 3 months, three patients had new deficits. Did that mean that the other 90% had no deficits if you followed them long term? That doesn't make sense. Is the tumor going to grow or not grow? That's what I want to know. What happened? Is all this worth it? Is that the question? Is all this worth it?
Well, yes. I mean, I would think it is, because extent of resection will inform long-term prognosis in terms of years of life. But when the GBM recurs in the adjacent motor cortex, are they going to get weak again? Yes, for sure they are. But the question here in terms of does this surgical technique work and result in safe outcomes, I think is also a yes.
Well, you're going to show some long-term results, aren't you?
Well, I'm showing results of the surgery. I'm not going to show long-term results for every tumor type because, again, this is a technical paper about does a sleep motor mapping result in safe motor outcomes, but not whether, because 20 of the patients have GBM, some have DNET, some have ependymoma, some have METs, and so they're all going to have very different 2 and 5 year natural histories. But this is about this technique being a safe operative approach.
Okay, why don't you finish?
So that if you look at the literature review for a sleep motor mapping, then we did a PRISMA analysis and looked through many hundreds of papers looking at mapping techniques and ultimately resulted in 13 that we thought were high quality papers between over 30 years approximately. And there are 252 patients with the sleep motor mapping techniques described in the literature. And the extent of resection rates described in the literature vary from 80 to 92%, pretty believable. And the gross total resection rates vary from 6.5% to 89%, depending on what paper you read. And the rate of permanent motor deficit ascribed to the surgery itself varies from 0 to 21%. From my experience, believable numbers. My sort of take-home conclusions about intraoperative stimulation mapping is that it improves the extent of resection. If you look in the literature and also our cohort versus our historical rates, it's greater than 75% in basically all series, including our own with mapping versus 58% historically without mapping, because people get nervous and they stop short, trying not to harm the patient. It decreases the rate of postoperative motor deficits versus not mapping. And it can be performed very effectively and easily under general anesthesia. As we talked about in the prior two slides, the gross total resection lags behind extent of resection because there's often a small amount of tumor that you very intentionally leave behind in motor eloquent lesions. And so gross total resection, which is a binary output number, will always be lower than extent of resection if you say that gross total resection is 100%, which is the metric that I use. And so these were some of the cases that we used with this technique. This first case, very interesting lesion. It was actually an ependymoma. It was resected 40 years previously in Lebanon, and then the patient moved to America later. And he had this recurrence in his 60s. His initial resection was when he was in his 20s. And so this was removed. And despite the fact that it looked like he should have a significant new motor deficit in his right hand following surgery, his motor function, in fact, improved because this was primarily compressive of his hand cortex because it was an ependymoma. And so you can see that area actually looks fuller after surgery, somewhat surprisingly. But I think that if you didn't have a motor mapping technique and you just saw this, you might be reluctant to take that patient to the OR for more than a biopsy. But to have positive motor signals throughout surgery is a very affirming thing for the surgeon, gives you some courage to keep going. And this is a hemorrhagic renal cell carcinoma metastasis in the motor cortex. And although there's no real technical challenge here, this presents close to the cortical surface. I used an ultrasound to make the cordisectomy. I also wanted to make the cortisectomy over a part of the cortex that didn't have any active motor sites. And so a sleep motor mapping was very helpful to plan the cortisectomy between that and ultrasound so that you have the shortest trajectory, but also the electrographically most silent trajectory. And I wrote some additional updates in neurosurgical oncology. In the interest of time, I don't think we have enough time to go through all of these, but I will say that these are some of the things that I've been incorporating into my practice more in the last 5 to 10 years. Laser interstitial thermal therapy is a laser-based therapy that's used, I think has particular promise for neurosurgical oncologists for regrowing lesions after radiosurgery. And Munir likely has a cohort of these patients that is hard to know exactly what to do to. You don't know if they have radiation necrosis or if they have progressive real tumor. And you may not feel comfortable doing a repeat radiosurgery session with them. And so RIT can be a nice therapy for that. Deep-seated or previously, you know, termed unresectable gliomas, butterfly gliomas, thoracic gliomas, more and more people are using RIT for those. Gammatile is a brachytherapy in which cesium seeds are implanted into something that's basically a collagen matrix like DuraGen. And there's an increasing experience with that in the States and likely will be transferred to other places soon as well. But gammatile is this idea of instilling intracranial brachytherapy along the resection cavity at the time of surgery. And so there's some anecdotal experience that was published in Neuro-Oncology Advances in the last few months for using this in recurrent high-grade gliomas. There's ongoing clinical trial looking at this for upfront treatment of the resection cavity for metastases that are surgically resected, as opposed to doing postoperative SRS to the cavity, which clearly has a benefit and is well published. 5-ALA, as I said, is useful for discriminating high-grade glioma tissue from normal brain. Frankly, I don't think that that's usually that difficult. High-grade glioma tissue looks pretty different than normal brain. Where I think that this could have significant use is low-grade gliomas. Right now, the signal-to-noise ratio for 5-ALA in low-grade glioma tissue versus normal brain is not sufficiently high, but the company and the investigators are working on ways to amplify that signal. And then neoadjuvant SRS is the idea of giving radiosurgery to metastases that you plan to surgically resect before you remove them. And this is in efforts to decrease the incidence of postoperative leptomeningeal disease, which is clearly increasing as cancer patients and brain metastases patients live longer. And so you would give neoadjuvant SRS, gamma knife, radiosurgery, LINAC, whatever system you use to the metastasis, and then take them to surgery in the next 1 to 7 days. And then the idea is that every cell that is in the tumor has already received a lethal dose of radiotherapy. And so if there is some microscopic spillage when you remove the tumor, because either you can't take it out on block or because you take it out on block, but there's still some microscopic spillage, then hopefully those cells will have received a lethal dose of radiotherapy and thus the incidence of leptomeningeal disease will be decreased. And then lastly, next generation sequencing, which we touched on in Dr. Munir's lecture about craniopharyngiomas. It has shown promise in several brain tumor states in which there are clearly mutations that can be targeted with medical therapies. I don't think it's the end all be all. And I think that it's hard to imagine that that's going to be the answer for malignant gliomas that have so many mutations. But for some tumors that clearly have a driver mutation or two driver mutations, this might be a part of the answer and decrease morbidity.
Can you leave the last slide up for a minute? Okay. Can we ask some questions, Samer?
Yes, sir.
First of all, Dr. Patel, I think really a very nice summary of what's going on in the field of oncology. I'm going to ask you some questions. I don't want you to take them personally, but I started working in this field in 1962, saw a patient who was treated with intracarotid methotrexate, that's the first early chemotherapy, and developed a brain tumor model the NIH used to screen BCNU and CCNU and wrote chapters on this. So and did work on the blood-brain barrier. I really am sorry about this, but there's a paper that was published, you might know. It was published in 1940 in the journal Brain by Dr. H.J. Scherer, S-C-H-E-R-E-R. You familiar with that paper?
I am.
And in that paper, he takes a series of 100 or so patients with different kinds of brain tumors. And he sections the brain from multiple sections from one end to the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the glioblastoma category, he found that about 30% of them would be localized.
Mm-hmm.
And the other 70% would be diffuse.
Yes.
Isn't that correct? And even diffuse to the point where they cross the corpus callosum to the other side of the brain.
Oh, yes.
Dr. Busey, Paul Busey, who founded Surgical Neurology International, was a very famous neurosurgeon at Northwestern.
Yeah.
Very controversial. Operated on a man, and he did a hemispherectomy to remove a glioblastoma. And he wrote an article. He was very honest. The man came back to curse me because it recurred in the other side.
Yeah.
And the answer is in Dr. Scherer's paper. Again, I'll say for the students who want to look that up, it's in Brain. It's March 1940, Scherer, S-C-H-E-R-E-R. It's an outstanding paper. I wrote a chapter in a textbook based on that. And so what he says is this tumor is basically incurable, except for perhaps a selected portion. And we don't know which portion that is. If you look at glioblastoma, isn't that correct?
I don't think any of them are curable.
Okay, I understand. That's an admission. Okay, I don't take it personally, but okay, that's very important. And so we started out, and we would take what we visually could see at surgery. It was nowhere as good as your resections using cortical stimulation and so forth and so on. So you can do much better than we do. And there was a paper published by the doctor who was head of neurosurgery at MD Anderson in Texas. Yes. And what he showed is he had this in a large series of patients. That's a paper that's quoted throughout neurosurgery. The more tumor you remove, the longer will be the survival. Right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you add it up, it turned out to be 2 months. That was the average length of survival he would add. And this is a disease. This is a disease that has an average mortality of 90% within 2 years, or 95%, and 50% in the first year. So neurosurgeons are dealing with this very complex disease. Then people developed some kinds of agents that image the tumor. That's where the 5-ALA came from. And we used to work on fluorescein, which would light up when you put ultraviolet light in the tumor bed and you take out what was shining under ultraviolet light. And the 5-ALA is just another iteration of that. The answer is neither works because of the fact that the tumor is infiltrative into the other hemispheres. And from Dr. Scherer's work, it's not only into one gyrus, it's into many gyruses or gyri. You agree with that? Okay. So now we have Dr. Berger who comes and he says, I don't like this. I'd like to do surgery. He worked with Dr. Ojeman, who is a seizure specialist, and he went ahead and he stimulated the brain and tried to say, I'm going to do a better resection because I'm stimulating and I'm not going to cause a deficit. And in his publications, he says he's got 3% of the patients who have a deficit after surgery. The question is that I asked you and I asked him, is how long do your patients live? I'm not getting that answer. And the question is if they live, and my guess is if in 70% of the tumor, 70% of the patients, you can't see the tumor, you can't image the tumor, it's going to stay there. That's going to recur. And if you look at the science, you have to have a log 10 to the 11th log of cells is 100 gram of cells. Mm-hmm. If you do a surgical removal, you reduce it by two logs. That's now to 10 to 9. You give them radiation therapy, you reduce it by another log. You know, you're 10 to the 8th. You give them chemotherapy, you got another log. That's 10 to the 7th. I still got mm-hmm. over a million cells.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to regrow. So what we're doing here is providing a patient with a temporary palliation from an incurable disease. Is that true?
Oh, of course. Of course. Okay. I don't think anyone would argue that, or I wouldn't argue
that. Well, no, they do. I do argue that. Because I appreciate it, and I appreciate what you're saying. But I want everybody to understand what the total perspective is here. So now we made some gains. And if we use the cortical electrodes and the stimulation, and you're shown with awake and sleep to surgery, and you can remove more. Question is, if I'm the patient, and I've been there, if I'm the patient, and I'm going to go through all this for 2 months more of my life, do I want to do it?
Yeah,
that's what Dr. Hadi said when he talked. That's what we talked after that about. Do we do the same thing for everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to ask the patient. So
I understand that. I've been a patient, okay, and I've been to a doctor. I've been with a randomized controlled study. For bladder cancer, the tumor went away for a while. It came back, and then I had choices of, well, I could do a variety of things, which would include more chemotherapy, which I had a 60% chance of overcoming. Or I could do a total cystectomy, totally remove everything. And I chose the latter. Why? Because I didn't want to be in the diminishing statistics. We can't do that in neurosurgery. Dr. Busey tried. He failed. And he wrote a paper honestly admitting it, because it's an infiltrative disease. And I think you're right. I think what we need to do is the patient needs to know honestly from the doctor what I can do to help you. If you want more time, I can try to give you more time. I have a pretty good success rate with this, but I can't stop the tumor from coming. Now, they're working on immunotherapy, and Linda Liao has some patients who last up to 5 years, but it's still a deadly disease. You disagree with anything I've said?
No.
Okay. Okay, so I just said I didn't say that to make it personal, but what I want people to understand is there are surgeons out there who are promoting a procedure like this. I'm not sure they're telling everybody what you're telling your patients. And that is that we're still humans. We don't know everything about this disease. I can do the very best I can to help you, just like Dr. Munir was doing with craniopharyngiomas. And he showed us you can get into trouble with that, which is very honest. And Dr. Mattash showed that in some of his patients. So what we're doing is trying to do the very best we can with something that has been a challenge for at least me in neurosurgery for 60 years. And are we further along than we were? To some degree, yes. In medulloblastoma, we're way far along. We've got genetic definitions of differences. You were beginning to talk about that here, and people are doing that, but it's not commonly available. So the question is, what can I do for you as a neurosurgeon? I'm not God. I can do the best I can do. And that's what Jorge was saying when I don't want to send a patient back to Peru who's paralyzed. Nobody wins. So I don't want you to take it personally. It's not a criticism. But my point is I've been in neurosurgery a lot longer than you have. To put this in the perspective of history, put it in the perspective of a person who's had cancers, to put it in the perspective of the fact that surgery isn't uncomplicated. I've had complications, which the surgeons didn't want to admit. So I'm basically trying to interject here into something called humility as a human being and humility as a neurosurgeon. What can I do for you? I'm here to do everything I can to help you, but I can't, unfortunately, I can't cure it. It doesn't mean I won't try. And if you want me to try, I will try. I made a practice out of taking all the cases no neurosurgeon wanted to do. They were 100% mortality if at that point. We were able to salvage a large number of those patients. So I commend you on your work. I commend you on what you've done. But I'm trying to present to the people here that there is a deeper message here that affects all of us as neurosurgeons. It doesn't matter if you're in Baghdad or if you're in Dallas, Texas, or if you're in UCLA and in Los Angeles. Because fundamentally, in the end, everybody faces the same human decisions. Okay, I apologize if I've offended you. I didn't mean to do that. I'm only trying to give the students a perspective and the young people a perspective on what Dr. Munir has been through, what Dr. Mahdi's been through, what Dr. Haas has been through, Jorge's been through. It's humbling to be a neurosurgeon. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, Summer. I'm very sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Dr. Patel, for this nice presentation. I think a huge lessons come from. I'm personally, I'm vascular guy. I use the monopolar for the eloquent area cavernoma, and it worked very well. Although initially, it's for me, it's a new experience to have the face area on different parts of the cortex. For me, oh, what's this? Yeah. I didn't expect that. But yeah, it was like subcortical cavernomas and just motor cortex cavernoma, but it went very, very well. At that time, we have only the monopolar, we use it. And yeah, the patient have no seizure. And it's very nice to understand more and more about those principles. Thank you. Thank you for your nice presentation. If anyone have any question on Dr. Patel's presentation, I know she has a time limit.
I want to say one other thing. Yeah. You're a very good doctor. You're a very empathetic doctor. There are doctors out there. There are people all over the world who are not necessarily as good people. We live in a world there where there's some evil people, and I don't need to tell that to the people in Iraq. There are doctors out there who want to do this surgery because it makes money. The patient doesn't matter. It makes money for the hospital, so they like it. Be careful. Don't sell your soul to the hospital, to the drug company. Don't sell your soul. It isn't worth it.
That's very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Patel, for this nice presentation. And it's very, very informative, I can tell. And nice to know you, and nice to have you here. And we hope we will meet you in the future. Thank you. Thank you for your talk.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it. Any comment or a question from the attendee or from the panel?
Well, I think the people who are left, if they could leave some comments, is this worthwhile for them or not? And we appreciate that. Munir, I'm continuously impressed with what you do. You're a good doctor. And Dr. Mahdi, this is the first I've met you. You just did a terrific job. And Dr. Thank you, sir. Patel, she's doing excellent work, and I, as I told many times, I didn't mean to make it personal. I just wanted people to know that you can have to find truth in science, but people may misuse it for other purposes. That's a danger in our world.
Yeah.
So I thank you all very much.
Thank you. Dr. Khalil already said that he has something and he should go early. After his presentation with background, Dr. Munir Faraj presentation with the cases, then Dr. Matti presentation, and then the update with the technique from Dr. Patel, we can now wrap up this meeting. And thank you everybody for the attendance. And see you next month, basically. And we have maybe extra meeting within 2 weeks, focus more on the student presentation. And we will keep you updated. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
We hope you enjoyed these presentations. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to receive CME credit. This series is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the Leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and Medical News Network. The recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions or comments to ausman@snidigital.org. Thank you.